Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold, black gold. You are.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kathy Bostrom from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Oprah. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. How to rewire your brain to find joy in stressful times. Try these simple steps from an aging expert by Carrie Burnight, PhD. Are you feeling it? According to the American Psychological Association's most recent Stress in America report, 77% of adults find that thinking about the future of our nation is a significant source of stress in their lives, joining an already relentless stream of other stressors: economic uncertainty, political polarization, international conflicts, misinformation, caregiving demands, and the pressures of an always-on society. I hear about this overwhelm from my patients, and I feel it too. It's showing up as restless sleep, distraction, a shorter fuse, and excessive scrolling. Stress doesn't just mess with your mood, it literally reshapes your brain. When you're under chronic stress, your amygdala, the fear center, goes into overdrive. You feel jumpy, irritable, and like everything's a threat. Your hippocampus, which helps with memory, shrinks, so you forget things, feel foggy, and can't think straight. And your prefrontal cortex, the part that helps you plan and stay calm, gets knocked offline. That's when small stuff feels huge and you just can't focus. Here's the good news. Our brains are remarkably adaptable. Neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to reorganize, rewire, and even grow new neurons, means that with the right tools and habits, we can repair what stress has eroded, enabling us to enhance emotional well-being, meaning, and inner joy. Yes, joy, even in adversity. Unlike happiness, which often relies on external conditions like a vacation or perfectly cooked burger, joy is an internal state of being. With all of life's challenges, it is easy and common to feel cut off from that core joy, but it can be cultivated, even amid turmoil, with what I call the joy span approach. The joy span approach is a four-part framework I created to tap into the joy that is within you. To practice it, remember the acronym CORE, C-O-R-E, which refers to four key actions: connect, open up, reach, and enrich. It sounds simple, but with daily practice, you can mitigate the effects of chronic stress and cultivate a deeper sense of joy. Over time, you'll find that, like the sun on a cloudy day, your joy has been there all along, but has been blocked out by the storms of constant strife. Let's dive into those four key actions. Connect. Be the one who reaches out. Whether introverted or extroverted, humans are biologically wired for connection. As author Herman Melville wrote, 1,000 fibers connect us with our fellow man. Neuroscience supports this. When you connect with someone by sharing a laugh, conversation, or hug, your body releases feel-good chemicals that calm your mind. One of the key players is oxytocin. It triggers your natural opioid system, which helps soothe feelings of anxiety and physical tension, creating a genuine sense of relief. And here's what's really remarkable. Studies tracking people over time have found that those with strong social support experience less shrinkage in critical brain regions as they age, especially in memory-related areas like the hippocampus. In other words, staying connected preserves your brain. But in our overscheduled, stress-saturated lives, how can we intentionally cultivate connection? Start small. Connection doesn't just happen. you need to take the initiative. Maybe it's sending a thinking of you message to a college roommate you haven't seen in years, or scheduling a coffee date with that friend who's been going through something. You don't need a dozen friends, but you do need a couple of people in your life whom you care about and who care about you. It might feel awkward to reach out, especially to people who aren't in your regular orbit. But remember that you're not the only one feeling lonely. When you take the initiative to connect, you are fortifying both yourself and the person you reach out to. Open up. Boost your adaptability. Change is the only constant in life, but that doesn't always make it easy or enjoyable. Adaptability, the ability to adjust to shifting circumstances, is key to mental well-being. It's not about white-knuckling it through life or pretending everything's okay, though. It's about giving yourself enough inner spaciousness to navigate the hard stuff without losing the capacity for joy. Adaptability is a skill, and like any skill, it can be practiced and improved. Studies show that practices like meditation and journaling, as well as breathing techniques and prioritizing sleep, actually rewire your stress defense system. For example, even brief mindfulness sessions have been shown to dampen the activity of the amygdala and strengthen connections with your prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that helps you stay calm, focused, and in control. I often recommend a short morning ritual, just 3 minutes of stillness, followed by 3 minutes of writing, not to solve your problems, but to soften around them, to build the muscle of noticing rather than reacting. It's a simple and effective daily practice. Reach. Stretch your limits a little. Personal growth builds brain resilience. When you challenge yourself with new or complex tasks, you strengthen your brain, making yourself more capable of handling adversity. This type of engagement also fosters cognitive resilience. Growth can start with something small and doable. Maybe you try a dish you've never had, take a different route to work, or sign up for that improv class you've been secretly curious about. Maybe it's doing the thing that scares you just enough to make your heart race, like finally speaking up in that meeting, trying rock climbing, or saying yes to karaoke. Or maybe your growth looks quieter, like asking better questions in your relationships, choosing to respond with empathy instead of defensiveness, or exploring your faith or spirituality in a deeper, more personal way. However it shows up, growth is anything that stretches you. Each strength builds resilience. Growth isn't about perfection or performance. It's about staying mentally engaged and curious, especially in hard times. And that will help you stay connected to your joy. Enrich. Practice the give of the day. There's a paradox I return to often in my work. The very act of giving is healing. When you enrich the life of another person, whether it's a big gesture or the tiniest act of kindness, your brain rewards you with a hit of serotonin, a reduction in cortisol, and often a renewed feeling of purpose. Giving brings a sense of control and meaning when life feels chaotic. And you don't need tons of money to make giving meaningful, either. A thank you note, a shared meal, or a kind word when someone least expects it all count. Even asking someone else how they're doing is an act of service. I practice something I call the give of the day. It's a small, deliberate offering to the world. Maybe it's a bag of lemons from your tree delivered to a neighbor. Maybe it's letting a harried mother cut in front of you in the grocery checkout line. The give doesn't fix everything, but it reminds us that we still have something to offer, because we do. Armed with neuroscience-backed tools, you can do more than just endure in hard times. You can thrive. No, I'm not asking you to bury your head in the sand and ignore the hard stuff, but I am asking you to choose, again and again, to live from your core. When you connect with others, open yourself up to adapt, reach for growth, and enrich the lives of those around you, it is possible to rediscover your inner joy in challenging times. I want that for you. Because joy is not a reward for surviving. It's how we'll survive. And that was How to Rewire Your Brain to Find Joy in Stressful Times by Carrie Bernight, PhD. Next is My Aunt Was Murdered Before I Was Born. I Still Miss Her. A serial killer took my aunt's life when she was just 20, but her legacy burns bright. By Daphne Wollstonecroft. I've never met my Aunt Carol, but I've loved her and missed her my whole life, especially when I remember that the last man to see her alive died in prison, with her fate still locked behind his vacant eyes. Even though I was born 10 years after her disappearance, I feel that I've always known her, from the way my smile tilts the same way hers did, to the way my mother's shoulders subtly tense when my own sister and I bickered over childish nothings. My mom seldom spoke of her sister. My grandmother, even less. Both were determined to halt grief from becoming the architecture of their lives. And yet, when they did speak of her, it was always with a kind of reverence, a bright wonder at who she was, not only what they had lost. They moved forward, quiet and strong, with a grace I now recognize as survival. In August of 1984, my aunt, Carol Wollstonecroft, vanished from Florida. She was 20 years old, luminous and unafraid, though in the weeks leading up to her disappearance, she was rightfully petrified of the man she lived with. He was 4 years older, charming at first, a cook at a Fort Myers bar and grill, where blonde, bubbly Carol also worked. Within a month, they moved into a modest house with others from the restaurant. But as the heat of summer thickened, so did her dread, as it became ever apparent that the devil doesn't always arrive in darkness. Sometimes, he walked in with a smile and the scent of fryer grease on his shirt. And, oh, did 24-year-old Eugene LeFay Jr. wear both like a disguise. It didn't take long for him to show Carol his true colors, though bad temper, violent, and drug dealer aren't names you'd find in a crayon box. Less than 3 months passed between their introduction and the night he's believed to have taken her life. My grandparents, Anne and Ed, were out of state when Carol reached out. First, a worried phone call. Then a letter. She couldn't say everything aloud, as she feared he might overhear. But one thing was clear. She needed help escaping the terrifying grasp of what seemed at first to be a whirlwind courtship gone wrong. As her parents would come to find, it was so much more than that. Before they learned the full story from the police, Anne and Ed promised her they'd come home early and suggested she stay at their house, or her grandmother's, until they returned. By the time they did so the following week, Carol's rust-colored 1981 Mazda GLC sat parked in their driveway. For a brief moment, relief swept through them, until they noticed through the window her keys still hanging from the ignition, and then a note in the kitchen from Eugene. Carol left, and I don't know where she is. They rushed to her home and found Eugene feigning ignorance, surrounded by all of Carol's belongings. Her clothes, her jewelry, every small detail that accentuated her feminine, polished persona. Most chilling of all was the gun on Eugene's dresser. At the sheriff's office, Anne and Ed unspooled the week's already unraveling thread. Carol's concerning correspondence, Eugene's contradictions, the growing dread that had pulled them home early. When they mentioned Eugene's weapon, the deputy stiffened. Eugene, they were told, wasn't allowed to have one. He was on probation, having served time for the rape of a 15-year-old girl, a crime carried out with threats and a metal club. The news landed with a grief all its own, especially since it was clear to them Carol hadn't known. But perhaps, in those final days, she had begun to piece his history together. Perhaps that's part of what scared her into wanting to leave him. Eugene claimed she'd left while he was visiting family, but when police followed his story, his relatives denied ever seeing him. His father eventually broke. Trembling, intimidated, he told investigators that on the night Carol vanished, Eugene arrived at his house demanding a shovel and the use of his car. He watched his son load a large object into the trunk of his Regal Buick and drive off. When he returned home, Eugene burned the shovel in the backyard, so his father said, threatening him against speaking of what he saw. But the mileage didn't lie. Eugene had driven 14 miles. To police and my family, it seemed that Carol had to be within a 7-mile radius. Yet somehow, she was nowhere at all. He would go on to kill again, at least 3 more lives extinguished in New York before the system finally caught up to him. He died in prison in 2016, silent to the very end, carrying with him the truth of what happened to Carol. Carol's memory lived like a ghost in our house. Not a loud, wailing specter, but a soft, persistent presence. I felt her most in what was missing. The holidays she wasn't at, the cousins I never had, the phone calls my mother didn't get to make. But perhaps most haunting of all was the way life simply continued without her. For as long as I can remember, I've carried a guilt that's hard to explain. The guilt of having a sister when my mother lost hers. Sometimes I would look at my sister and think of my mom at 22, shattered and brave, trying to find footing in a world that had just stolen her only sibling. It felt cruel that she had to navigate that grief alone, across the country in Los Angeles, with nothing but the gnawing unknowing at her side. The idea that someone good, bright, innocent, only 20, could be stripped of life so violently shaped me from a young age. Not necessarily into someone fearful, but into someone watchful. I came to understand that when someone disappears, it doesn't just disrupt the moment. It fractures generations. It stirs through families like a twister, scattering what once seemed permanent. But Carol's legacy isn't just one of sorrow. It's resilience. My mother never let her grief define her. My grandmother still found reasons to smile. And in that quiet, unwavering endurance, I learned something sacred. Survival isn't always loud. Sometimes it's the gentle choice to keep living, even when a vital piece of your universe has been taken. That's what led me to create Going West, a true crime podcast that often tells the stories of the missing, the voiceless, the unresolved. And it's what pushed me to write my novel, Night Watcher, a fictional story woven from threads of truth about justice, memory, and what we owe the ones we've lost. Carol didn't get a trial. She didn't get a headline. She didn't even get a grave. But we think of her often, not just as a woman who was swallowed by violence, but as a woman who could have been. I imagine her children, her laugh at age 40, at age 60. I grieve not only the loss, but the possibility. Because while I may never know exactly what happened to my Aunt Carol, I do know what came after. I know the strength of the women she left behind. I know the stories they carry. I know the beautiful shape of what should have been. And I know, without question, that remembering her is its own kind of justice. That was My Aunt was Murdered Before I Was Born, I Still Miss Her, by Daphne Wollstonecroft. Next we have, so you've achieved a big personal goal. Now what? How to Handle the Letdown That Happens After Crossing a Major Finish Line, by Mara Reinstein. My low point was Missouri. An arduous hill at mile 10 had reduced me to a hunched-over shuffle walker, and the heat from the asphalt felt like it was radiating right into my brain. Suddenly, a wiry man with white hair, who could have theoretically grown up with my grandpa, sidled up to me. Patting me on the shoulder, he joked that if he could finish this race, then so could I. All I could muster was a half smile and a meek thumbs up. I was going to do it, of course. I had to. I was fulfilling the higher purpose of running a half marathon in 50 states, a goal I set to push my physical endurance while traveling the country. One hellish incline in downtown St. Louis wasn't going to stop me. Now it's all over. After 14 years of huffing and puffing, I finished Project 50 in Alaska in July. I persevered through a pandemic, chronic tendonitis in my right ankle, and 3 kidney stones, not to mention some ghastly weather. Thanks for nothing, Tennessee. I wish I could tell you that I crossed that finish line by raising my arms toward the heavens and basking in unbridled jubilee. But I really just side-hugged my mom and my teen nephew, who ran the race with me and insisted on sprinting to the finish seconds before I did, and then slurped down lukewarm lo mein noodles in a desolate food court in a downtown Anchorage mall. Then I took a red eye back to New York City. Then I went back to pecking away on my laptop. I also refused to post about the big race on my socials because, in my mind, a public acknowledgement would officially declare that my cross-country quest was in the past tense. And that would mean I would have to finally stare down the frightening question that's haunted every sleepless night in the last few years and since I finished. The guy behind the register at my local running store had asked me once, but I was conveniently able to shrug it off with the excuse that I was too focused on my upcoming race. Alaska always just seems so far away, on every level. Now that question looms so large that I'm going to type it in all caps. What's next? Look, I get it. It warms the heart to read about how someone overcame the obstacles to accomplish an impressive long-term goal. But I want to delve deeper than that feel-good story into the tangled mess of other wholly unexpected emotions that settle in once said goal is achieved. At any given moment, I'm a ball of anxiety, ennui, sadness, and fear. Basically, every character from Inside Out 2 minus Joy. My big to-do involved crossing a literal finish line, or 50 to be exact. For many others, it's a metaphorical one that carries significant personal meaning. Yet crossing it doesn't culminate in a milestone party where loved ones offer presents and profuse congratulations. Think along the lines of mastering for release as an adult. Fitting into those pre-maternity, early aughts era jeans. Expertly recreating your grandmother's matzo ball soup. Completing the Sunday New York Times crossword puzzle without Googling. These are big friggin' deals. Yet the restlessness lingers and lingers. Humans are remarkably good at getting used to positive changes in their lives, explains Sonia Lubomirsky, a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. So when we reach a goal, like finally saving enough money for that new car, we're happy at first and feel rewarded. But then we adapt and want something more. It can happen to anyone at any level. On the positive side, forward thinking, that drive to want more and more, is the key to societal and technological progress. Imagine if Steve Jobs hadn't set out to create an iPhone, the keypad texting horror. The problems arise when we expect to find some sort of pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It's a phenomenon called arrival fallacy, says Stephanie Harrison, author of the self-help book New Happy, who has a master's degree in positive psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. It's a cognitive distortion. We think that once we get somewhere or achieve something, we'll feel happiness. Then you don't actually feel that satisfaction. It can be an intense come down. So what should you do next when experiencing what's next panic? 3 suggestions. Stop putting pressure on yourself. Contrary to popular belief, you don't need to continue to raise the bar. That's a collective you. There's an obsession in our culture, and by extension, friends, family, institutions, and social media, that we've got to push and go bigger, Harrison says. So then you invariably feel like what you do is not good enough. That pressure can strip away what's been really good for your well-being and turn it into something that hurts you. Indeed, I know my friends mean well when they ask if I'm now going to race in every country or every continent, but I'm left feeling stressed and depressed, as if what I already did just isn't enough. The reality is that it's okay. Strike that. It's professionally recommended to wave off these comments and just roll around in the accomplishment for the long haul. Notes Harrison, instead of chasing, stay in the experience. Integrate your achievement into your identity so it becomes not just something you did, but a part of who you are. It's a mental shift in the way you see yourself. In doing so, you enrich your self-concept. Change the goal, keep the mindset. It turns out there are two types of happiness. One form is euphoria from reaching the mountain peak or winning a medal or hearing applause. The other is more purposeful. The highs are not as high, but it provides you with a baseline level of contentment that can get you through difficult times, Harrison says. That's why she recommends that as we move forward, we seek out the motivation that got us out of bed and busy in the first place. Recapture that energy and enthusiasm, she says. You already have intrinsic perseverance because you never gave up on your original goal. Now cultivate those qualities by channeling it into something else and committing to it. Example, if you finally painted and displayed that gorgeous canvas but now feel adrift and drained, keep engaging that creative side of your brain. Maybe give ceramics a spin or photography. Though you may not find that addictive hedonic elation for a hot minute, she says, you'll achieve a longer, more sustainable form of happiness. Live in the now. Am I dating myself too much by referencing Ferris Bueller? Because that iconic 80s movie character was right. In that life moves pretty fast. You need to stop and look around or else you may miss it. Because the truth is, our real accomplishments extend well beyond that all-important checkbox. We can move our bodies. We can afford music lessons. We have the fortitude to keep going. We have a support network to cheer us on. The sooner we realize these strengths, the easier it is to get in the proper headspace to celebrate with gusto. Have a party, give a toast, write a poem, post photos, whatever you want, she adds. After all, we really do deserve a victory lap. That was So You've Achieved a Big Personal Goal, Now What? By Mara Rheinstein. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kathy Bostrom, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Told you so.